listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2000. You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. So I had a very strange weekend, and I read Miranda July's wonderful book, Under Very Strange Circumstances. A car lost its brakes and came down the hill in Silver Lake, where I live, and crashed into a power pole across from my house, plunging our neighborhood into darkness on Saturday night. So I read Miranda's book, It Chooses You, by the light of a headlamp. And that focused but unlikely illumination turned out to be just right for reading these beautiful and surprising stories that Miranda July unearthed in our sprawling city. The premise of her book, It Chooses You, is deceptively simple. While trying to write a film script, Miranda July finds herself procrastinating, and who doesn't? You know, we're all looking at computer screens, you know, you can click on anything. It's so easy to get distracted. So she turns to the Penny Saver Circular, that classified booklet that appears all over Los Angeles, and she begins to wonder, who are the people who advertise these wares? Care Bears, old photo albums, an old hair dryer, used leather jackets. And she decides to visit them to see, as she says, what can be found accidentally. She weans herself from her computer to find those people we cannot do a web search for. Imagine that. She knocks on the doors of strangers, observing that people will tell her about themselves, though she knows she isn't, quote, a reporter or anyone of consequence. And she realizes that everyone's story matters to themselves, and then proceeds to make them matter for us as well. Who else but Miranda July would think to ask a Penny Saver seller for their earliest memory? It Chooses You is a meditation on the documentary impulse and an insight into the creation of fiction. Miranda roams Los Angeles from Sun Valley to Vista, from Glendale to Paramount, looking for secret clues that people are leaving her and that will help her write her film. And lying there in the darkened house by the light of my headlamp, I came across the sentence that made the whole book glow to me. All I ever really want to know, she writes, is how other people are making it through life. Where do they put their body hour by hour, and how do they cope inside of it? It's a huge subject, and it's one that animates much of Miranda July's extraordinary body of work. As I'm sure most of you know, Miranda is a writer, a filmmaker, and a performer. You may have followed one of her art assignments on the website Learning to Love You More, her collaboration with the artist Harold Fletcher. She's the author of No One Belongs Here More Than You, winner of the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award. Her writing has appeared in The New Yorker and The Paris Review. And she wrote, directed, and starred in the film Me and You and Everyone We Know, which won the Camera d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. And her second film, The Future, which was released this summer, I think comes out today on DVD. So if you haven't seen it, you can see it now. She'll be joined in conversation with journalist and memoirist Joshua Bierman, who's written for Rolling Stone and the New York Times, McSweeney's, The Believer. And you can download Josh's wonderful stories from This American Life as podcasts. We're very happy to welcome Josh Bierman and Miranda July to the library. Miranda will begin with a reading. Please welcome Miranda July. Thank you. Nice.
Hello. Hi. Thank you so much for coming to the library. Okay. So I'll just read a little bit here before Josh and I start talking. I've been sick in bed for days, so this is a dramatic change from where I've been, and I have no idea what will happen, like, voice-wise here. So we'll just hope for the best. So this is kind of far into my vision quest, as I began to think of it, driving all over. I mean, this is so nice doing this in LA, actually. I haven't talked about this book in LA, and you guys know how many places there are that we hear about, like Bell and Vista, and, you know, that, like, I don't know, maybe you all live in Bell and Vista, but not to make assumptions, but, like, you just live here quite happily. There's no problem with having absolutely no idea, you know, where these places are or what they are like, what they look like. So, you know, and from the phone number, you can't tell in the classifieds where you're going to have to go, you know. And I was so excited when they would want to do the interview, and then I'd be like, okay, where do you live? I've got my pen. And I'd be like, wow, okay, no problem. I've got MapQuest and or my phone. So Ron, where did Ron live? He lived in Woodland Hills. I feel like that's in the, like, KCRW, something Woodland Hills, you know, that's right here. Hear that. That's really not that far away. Okay. So Ron is probably in Woodland Hills tonight. Okay. Ron tried to convince me, oh, you know what we can do? I do have some, the book has these great photographs in them. And so as much as I remember to, I'll show you the slides. Ron tried to convince me to interview him over the phone. He said he had his reasons for not wanting me to come over. But then suddenly he changed his mind and gave me his address. As I knocked on the door, I braced myself for facelessness, or no head, or a head but no body, a head on wheels. But Ron had a body with a head and even a baseball hat. He was the most average person I'd ever seen. In preparation for our meeting, he'd laid out items all over the bed and floor, brand new books and DVDs and a 67-piece art set. That's what he was selling for $65, a 67-piece art set. They were mostly for children. Mrs. Doubtfire was in attendance, as was Hop on Pop, and they all seemed vaguely ill-gotten. The apartment was small, and he sauntered around setting up chairs for us. So I'll read Ron, too. This is him. I went through a little bit of trouble to take some stuff out of my closet and throw it on here for you. Yeah, thank you. Not much trouble, just a little. Well, I really appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time. What did you say you do for a living? I'm a corporate owner. Okay, can you elaborate on that? I run a financial investment corporation. I use margin. I use the money from the banks, and then I take the money from the brokerage room at 8 or 9% only for the day that I use it. If you borrow it for a day and then you sell the stock the same day, this is what people don't know. If you have $10,000, you can borrow $10,000 from the brokerage firm, and then that's $20,000. You can use that $20,000 that day and sell it the same day, and the $10,000 you borrowed from the brokerage firm, you don't pay any interest. Okay. I'm not especially terrific with numbers, so it was as if he'd just thrown some confetti in the air and called it numbers, called it words. I tried to listen harder. Maybe I would learn something here. Maybe he could explain taxes to me later. If you hold it overnight, you owe them that money for one day, 9% interest for just a day divided by 365, so it's almost like pennies. Right. It adds up if you hold it for weeks and months. Right, I see. You see what I'm saying. Yeah. I'm a numbers person. Always been good with numbers, always loved numbers, very quick with numbers. In elementary school, I was an A student up until about fifth grade. When it came to fractions, then I had a little trouble. Right. And because of that, I had what you call thousands of hours of blackjack experience when I first started in Atlantic City. Unfortunately, I had beginner's luck. I wasn't good, but I had beginner's luck, and so I won. And then after a while, I lost, and I won, and I lost, and I won, and I lost, and eventually I lost more than I won. Let's see. The discussion of blackjack was long and detailed. He tried to explain what card counting was, why it was illegal, and how what he did was legal, even though, technically speaking, it was card counting. Asking a question was like merging onto the freeway. I had to accelerate and jump into one of his pauses. What are your plans for the future? Well, I've had a period of several years of my life that was torture and torment, and I didn't have the option to get married. Right. Can you read into that? No. It's It's about to be over in a couple months. Okay. And it was business related. Okay. Business related Martha Stewart type. He lifted his pants leg a little bit to reveal a house arrest anklet. Oh, okay. Okay, right. It's just about over. It'll be nice to have that off. I said this cozily, almost maternally. The important thing was to continue behaving exactly as I had before I'd known he was under house arrest. A lot of people might have flinched, but hopefully he noticed that I had not. I'm gonna skip ahead here. Ron was exactly the kind of man you spend your whole life being careful not to end up in the apartment of. And since I was raised to go out of my way to make such men feel understood, I took extra special care with his interview. But as he talked on and on, the original transcript was more than 50 pages, I realized that I don't actually want to understand this kind of man. I just want them to feel understood, because I fear what will happen if I'm thought of as yet another person who doesn't believe them. I want to be the one they spare on the day of reckoning. Bridget is the woman who took the photographs, and then I also brought my assistant, Alf, so there would be a man there. Bridget had stopped taking pictures and was hanging out near the door with wide eyes. Alfred had become very still and silent somewhere behind me. What do you love to do? I love to sing. What do you like to sing? I like, for example, there's a song called Teenager in Love. The Everly Brothers? Dion and the Belmonts, or maybe just Dion. Sometimes I really want to just belt it out and release that tension. Yeah, people who sing, it's like they can pour out emotion in a way that other people can't. Well, I'll tell you. And here's the bottom line of what people have always told me. They've said I've always been good with kids. I worked in Reseda through a court order monitor. When the husband had a court order for the wife that required somebody to be there for the kids, or the wife had an order, I was the one there. So that tells you how risky of a kind of person I am, okay? Yeah. The court checked my background out. I did that in the 80s part-time, and actually had a problem because a lot of the kids were requesting me, and the agency says, hey, Ron, there's too many people requesting you. Yeah. I'm good with kids. I know how to get down on their level and enjoy myself with them. Not a Michael Jackson type, but no, I understand. What's been the happiest time in your life so far? A happy time was when I had a 3-year relationship with a younger girl when I was 26, a girl that I truly, truly loved, but she was too young to marry. And I told her, in a couple of years, when you're 18, if you feel that way, let me know then. But I knew she would spread her wings and see what life was all about. I was smart enough to know that. So that was a happy time. That was a really happy time. Another good time was being with a woman out here that was much older than me until she had to go into a home. I actually had to call her two sons that were about my age to let them know that she was going to hurt herself. That must have been hard. I mean, it was like a steady, very steady thing with her and I, and she was much, much, much older than me. How old was she? I'll just say she was well into her 70s, but she was slender, she was clean, she was soft-spoken, she was the love of my life. After a long time, I began to understand that he would never let us leave. We just had to go. I silently counted to 3 and stood up. I brushed off my thighs, as people do, and made thank you sounds and gestures. As we said goodbye and walked toward the door, Ron stopped me. Miranda, quick question. Yeah? Do you have a family? Mm-hmm. Kids? No kid. Whoops. That's him. Kids? No kids. I just got married. Oh, you just got married. Yeah. I was going to say, someone as adorable as you can't be single, but then people always say that about me, too. Well, thank you. I wish I wish we didn't have another interview after this. Yes, okay. We could stick around. That's okay. I took too much of your time. Yeah, well, it was really great. It's been a pleasure. I'll read you, because this is LA, just that the next thing I did. So, you know, I was trying to make this movie at the same time. So I was also meeting with actors. And I tell one story of meeting with an actor right after this. After I interviewed Ron, I had a meeting with an actor who had read my script and was considering the role of Marshall. It was Don Johnson from Miami Vice. As usual, I was early, so I drove around and got lost, which made me late, as usual. I parked on the street and then walked up to a big gate and pressed a button that alerted a video camera. I waved and then tried to say something about how he didn't need to open up the gate all the way because I wasn't driving in. I held up my hands to the camera to indicate the width of my body. The gate began rolling open. I slipped through, but it kept on opening. Even after I was seated inside across from Don in his den, I could still hear the gate opening. And then it reversed direction and started the long journey home. Don was good-looking and very solid, the way men often become in their 50s. Sometimes men with this kind of body ask you to punch them. That didn't happen this time. We talked about meditation and Buddhism. I couldn't remember if he'd had any drug problems, but I hoped he had come to meditation through recovery. It's always a relief to me when someone is in recovery. It automatically gives us something to talk about. Not that I'm in recovery specifically, but I relate to the feeling of trying and failing and trying again. People who've been through rehab are used to talking about this. They're required to. Don and I talked about being present and the elusiveness of now, and then he praised the talents of his son for a while, which predictably moved me to tears. To keep from crying, I had to do the trick where you contract your butt into a tiny fist and mentally repeat the words, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. We discussed the script, and I suggested he audition for the part, which is the one thing you're never supposed to say in these meetings. Apparently it's insulting, which I always forget. So the meeting was suddenly over. He walked me out, the gate opened, and it was still opening when I drove away. Okay. So, Josh, it's time for you to come out. Okay, here he comes.
You?
Yeah, that's your cue.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, that was great to hear it after having read it a couple times. I will say, I don't know how many people have read the book. How many people have read the book, actually, so already?
Oh.
So still a few.
It just came out like a week ago, so that's great.
Well, it is a very lovely book. I mean, the writing is incredible, and the stories are great. And
thank you.
I guess what I wanted to start talking about first is the basic structure of the book is you've got these interviews and these stories that you've collected from these people that are selling their items on the Penny Saver, and then interspersed with that is your own, you're looking for something and you're sort of going on this adventure. Right. And so I just wanted to, this was like a new format for you doing something that is autobiographical and nonfiction.
Right.
So I just kind of wanted to talk to you about what that experience was like for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I was full of trepidation. I mean, I remember lots of conversations. I guess I shouldn't give away the ending, should I?
No. Yeah, no,
that, no
yeah.
Okay, I
not,
won't do
yeah.
that.
Not in the first sentence.
Okay, that would be horrible. but I, you know, after I did these interviews, I made a whole movie. So a lot of time went by, and I didn't have to come back and make the book. And I kind of wondered, like, why am I doing that? Like, especially because, yeah, nonfiction is not my thing. I mean, no one's going to notice if I don't do this book. There's zero demand for it, you know.
Because at the time, it truly was procrastination when you first started.
Yeah, when I was doing it, I mean, I had no... in fact, you know, when I brought Alf with me, he videoed because I was like, maybe I'm making a documentary. Who knows? Maybe this movie isn't going to work out and all, you know, this will be the movie. Yeah, it was very open-ended, which made my case so flimsy when on the phone. You know, it wasn't like I could be like, I'm from PBS, and we're, you know, but it, like, it was just all very vague seeming. Yeah, but then you know, so a lot of this is also just me thinking about fiction, and then the process of writing it was sort of like, well, what does it mean when I is really me? And it kind of made me look back at all my work, which people always think is so revealing and autobiographical, but really isn't. I mean, I'm not that daring that I'm going to like make a movie about my affair, you know, like that's just, you know, I made that up to get it a feeling that seemed like the best way to describe it. So this was, yeah, it was, you know, the point of like, why would you do that? Why would you tell the real truth you know, if you're not that interested in like exposing yourself, was a real process.
At what point was it? So you're collecting all these stories and it's other people's stories that you're sort of deeply fascinated by wandering through their doors. And then at what point did you sort of turn that and you realized it was all your story that was going to connect all of them?
Not till I think I sort of pitched that, you know, this was published by McSweeney's, and because I knew that people would want there to be my writing in it. You know, no one really cared about these people in LA. And so I said, like, there will be a whole bunch of writing that I am going to do. And there would be like, well, what can we see an example of this writing? At which point I was like, I need to do this with McSweeney's. They'll just trust me on this. You know, I had all kinds of thoughts when I did this that obviously I was still thinking about, or I wouldn't have wanted to do the book. I mean, I knew, and it was quite easy, actually. And then I also began to realize, like, that I that I think of as so different, it's really easy for me to just be a character. I mean, it's all true, but, like, and that's when it got kind of fun, like, the character of me, you know? Yeah. But you have to be a lot more honest. You can't just make up what that person's thinking or doing. You know, it's the truth. Yeah.
Well, I liked how, I mean, at the beginning, you sort of set this image of yourself going, when you are going on your first trip, I think, to get the leather jacket, and you
get
some supplies, and you've got your, like, yogurt, you pack your bag, and it's like, and you've got your tape recorder, and you're like,
right,
going on like a journalist or detective, I think you described maybe you're going to be.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, there's like a similarity potentially to those like sober kind of like fact-finding professions looking for factual-based truth, and then you're also there looking for some kind of like artistic truth potentially. Or did you even think about it that way? Were you?
No, I was really lost. I mean, and you know how when you're actually stuck and lost, and, you know, I didn't have financing for the movie that I couldn't finish, it's not a good feeling. It's not like a profound, like, I have a new book out feeling. It's, you know, really uncomfortable, and it doesn't go away when you stop working. You know, it's just kind of hanging around as you eat and try and be nice to other people. And, you know, so I was always looking, because I wanted that security of knowing what I was doing about something, you know? So I was always trying to find, like, oh, this is the reason, you know, or this is what I've learned. And I also felt, because I was with these two other people, like, and I was their leader, like, you know, sometimes we'd get back in the car and I would sort of summarize what was profound about that, you know? Because it could just seem really like, why are we doing that? You know,
right.
This is,
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And you're like, what we have seen here today.
Yeah.
And you're like taking notes in your field notebook.
Yeah. Though, to be honest, it was usually pretty obvious. And that was reassuring too, you know, that I had these people who weren't in a way that invested. You know, they didn't need it to be anything, but they were really.
Were there any times you got back in the car and everybody was just silent because you'd all seen the same thing and you didn't even have to discuss what was compelling
about
it?
Well, after Ron, for sure. we were really, yeah, I remember saying something like, how long did he say his house arrest was for? You know, just wanting it to like,
be forever.
And like, yeah, be forever. I've thought about that more recently, of course. Yeah, but for, you know, I read that one, and that was really the only person who had it, had a sort of darkness about him. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Well, to take a counterexample, which is the first one, that Michael, the man, transgender person,
yes,
who has the leather jacket. Well, first of all, it's interesting to kind of think about, that's the first person you saw, and you're going on this like vision quest to look for meaning or something,
right.
And like it's the most meaningless thing, actually, this kind of like leather jacket that is like a million other things. But then you go in there and you find this kind of, it's sort of this inspirational experience. Do you want to describe a little bit,
yeah,
what that was all about?
I mean, I didn't know on the phone, and then, yeah, he opens the door a crack. And I'm totally nervous because this is the first one. And he says, before he lets me in a really soft voice, he's like, I'm going through a gender transformation. And I was just like, great, you've come. I am so the right person. If you're worried about that, like, I'm from Berkeley. I don't, you know, it's just like, I'm so okay, yeah, with that. You don't even know. And, you know, not that I wasn't just totally nervous because I didn't know him and it was the first time.
Yeah. But then he kind of, and he goes on to describe how he's in kind of a flop house and on Social Security and is in his 60s,
mm-hmm,
right? And is kind of like at some stage of the procedure. And it's kind of a sad seeming scene, but then he's like, no, I'm totally happy. I've got everything. I know exactly what I want in life and here I am. And so you kind of have this realization, well, like, if he's sitting there and he's happy, then...
Yeah. And I think, yeah, there was also the feeling of, like, just that dislocation when you step out of your own life and you're, like, your problems are just so urgent and you engage with someone else's problem, you know? And he said, like, you know, I said, you know, is there anything you still want that you haven't gotten? And he said, no, just to become a woman. And, you know, it was like, it just, you know, I walked out of there feeling like, well, I'd rather be lost talking to other people than lost alone in my own spiral. Like, that's why that was such a convincing first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he says, and I remember being struck by, he says, he's so, essentially so happy that when you ask him, like, what's your happiest time, he can't even say, because they're all the happiest time.
Yeah.
Right? And then you're sort of left with that, like, oh, right, well, I guess this does put things in perspective a little bit.
Yeah.
But, I mean, did you have any idea that you would sort of find something like that when you set out with your bag and your recorder and everything?
Right. No. Of course not. And to be honest, then after him, I was like, okay, everyone's going to be transgendered. And like, I just kept jumping to conclusions or, you know, and then the next woman I think was, well, first of all, she was really wealthy, which just was like, yeah. I thought at least everyone's going to be poor. She was, are we going to talk about
her?
Yeah, she was actually raising money, selling saris for a small town in India. Very labor intensive way to raise money, like $5 saris through the penny saver, you know. But she, like a lot of other people I interviewed, she had a sort of old world sense to her, you know, like this, it made sense sort of why this was the way she was fundraising. And yeah, and then at that point, I kind of let go and realized, like, okay, my preconceptions of why you would do this, you know, are not, like, each one was totally different. And, you know, it seems very edited because everyone's so interesting. But I think I cut out two people, and they were so interesting, but it wasn't in the words, you know? Uh-huh. Like, it's weird. With a book, it has to be in the interview, you know? It can't just be, like, all the experience.
Yeah.
So.
Really? So there were only, I actually was going to ask how many people didn't make the cut. Or was there anybody just, you went and you're just like, nah, it's not interesting?
No. There was one woman. Okay, it was three. Okay, there were three I didn't use. Who was so interesting. I think she was Persian, but she would not reveal anything. It was like she was under, like, orders from her husband. So we'd ask a question, she'd be like, and we were like, what? You know? And she'd be like, and we just walked away just like, oh my God, you know, like it was so full with answers, but no, literally nothing. That was the only time when like there was.
So she had agreed for you to come and interview her.
Yeah,
and then just
she was so interesting. At one point she started crying a little bit.
Oh.
And no rhyme or reason, just based on one of the questions, like, but really gave us literally nothing. I was just like, what is on this tape? Like just me asking questions. Yeah.
With Pramila, so the woman who's selling the saris, she also kind of, it's interesting because it comes on the heels of Michael, and then she also gives you this explicit inspirational message, like, reach for the rainbow or something, right? And you kind of, like, note them down, but then you pull back a second because you're like, well, but it's not because you're cynical all of a sudden. It's like you kind of want to resist simplification, and there you talk about, at that point, you make this determined effort to not kind of create a fictionalized version of these people. You want to keep the real people in focus. And why did that, where did that come from? Like, what was?
Right. Well, I mean, I make stuff up. That's what I do. And most of the time you can see someone and just totally rip them off. I mean, I do that every day. no one even knows I'm doing it. Except for a few friends who are kind of annoyed. Yeah, that wasn't the point of what I was doing, and I it was so hard not to try and make the story as I was sitting with them to be like, okay, you know, what is the detail I would use if this was a movie or if this was a book, you know, like to decide what was interesting or you know, so often I would want to make the story by deciding there was something really heartbreaking about them, you know, and I'd have to kind of talk myself out of that and be like, they're fine. I just want this to be so poignant that I know what to feel right now because I'm so far away from my own world, which more and more kind of became the point.
But ultimately, you did wind up pulling.
I know.
from this whole process into your film fairly extensively. Not even just with Joe, who is the person we'll talk about later, I guess. But I mean, I guess sort of like the animal husbandry section, I guess, where you go out to the desert and you deal with the Beverly, right? Who's got all the baby leopards? Is that
right?
Her name?
You think that's
well, just because like that's all about sort of like creating like a caretaking in life, and then later is when your dog runs out in the street and the cat gets run over, and then that becomes Pawpaw. In the film, and like, okay. So you sort of like, there's like a debt of gratitude to a lot of different people in here for elements.
Right. Well, yeah, that's just like that in the book. That wasn't really the order. I think I had Pawpaw before I met her, but there was a lot of cats through the, I mean, there's a reason this is on the, I mean, it was, yeah, I was surrounded by cats through the whole process. Yeah.
It's interesting. I bought a bunch of stuff from Craigslist recently, and I hadn't in a while. And I did notice when you go to somebody's house, kind of like in Pacoima or somewhere, like every time they open the door, and you're always like, "What is going on back in there?" You know, where they're wheeling this weird thing out that you're buying. And even though I'm a journalist, where also all my stories are about some weird, tiny, marginal person and their obsession, it never once occurred to me to ask these people about their lives. And so, but I've been in those situations before, so I really liked reading this book and imagining you sitting in these people's houses for hours on end, sort of being caught up in their realms.
Yeah. Yeah, and it, I think it's sort of the point where you, I'm not a journalist. I'm not actually that good at that. I'm used to everyone knowing who I am, who's working with me, you know?
Yeah.
Or not that they're even working with me. You know, like, I'm your director and, you know, I will guide the, you know, and yeah, no, it could have cared less. No one had any point of reference for me. And I, in fact, I began, it, there was no point in really describing my work. I began saying, like, I'm just a curious type of person. That was like, and everyone knows someone like that, you know, and it's true. And it was sort of more to the point than being like, my first movie, Me and You, and ever, you know, like, it just, yeah, and I think the, it's like, it's always scary at the beginning asking someone about their life because you forget that that's allowed. I mean, especially, so much when I was doing this, I thought about how, especially in LA, you know, you're sort of supposed to stay in your lane. Like, this is an okay, this event is your, in your lane. Trader Joe's is in your lane. there's, you know, all the things that are kind of in your world, and you just, not because there's any law, you just mostly stay in there. You know, and whatever it is, you know, whatever it is, I don't want to assume you all have variations on that. And so to, like, radically kind of swerve and be like, well, what if I go over here? What movie is that like? Like in The Truman Show? For some reason, I'm always referring to that movie. That's where, like, it's a whole movie of his life, and then he, like, tries to derail it by, like, making a left turn where he usually makes a right, you know? I mean, it wasn't exactly like that, but you feel like something very wrong is going to happen, or they're going to be like, well, why are you asking this? And then you realize in just answering the first question, you know each other. You become a person that knows them a little bit. And then by the second question, they've told you something a little bit more, and you become deserving of hearing their story. Like, you become kind of, they kind of anoint you. And then by the end, often there's this, like, real intimacy, because, not because you've asked questions and demanded it, but because they've given you their space, and they've given it to you, and then that makes you valuable to them. You know, or that you relevant to them. You're the person who has their story now.
Yeah.
So now you get to see the house, and now you get, you know, and we're all like that. It's sort of, but I think that was what struck me. Like, it's not some magic trick. Like, really, we all could just, you're allowed to do that, you know. Less so now, I would say, with the internet. but yeah.
But I mean, also, well, but that leaves you as the, so now you have the story, and then now you're the storyteller, so you have this problem of perspective where you have to kind of account for the fact that you're, you know, like, some of the scenarios are weird, or there's some of the stories are sad, and there's, like, some, and there's class divisions, and, you know, you have to represent sort of how strange things are, because sometimes the most meaningful thing is in the strangest detail. So you have to, like, sort of deal with the weirdness and with the you know, the glory of it, but not kind of push in either direction too much and have this balance, which you do really well. I struggle with it all the time as a journalist because I'm dealing with weirdos and I want to make them weird but lovable. I actually do the opposite. I make them really weird and really lovable rather than, like,
right,
halfway.
No, you were saying when we were talking about this, like, there's so many things where as a journalist you were like, well, why? What more is there? And I'm just a polite woman. I'm not a journalist. So I took it to the limits of my discomfort or theirs. And
well, then you wind up with some good interview tactics where with Andrew, is that?
Yeah, with the bullfrog tadpoles.
Yeah, and you at a certain point, sort of the obvious next question is like, oh, this is like, well, it's you must be kind of sad or angry about things, but you resist and you try to say, the opposite, actually, of what your instinct is.
Oh, right.
And then that turns out to be more true, and you're like, well, this is a pretty good time in your life. And he's like, yeah, it is.
Right, yeah, yeah. He had just gotten done telling me about how he had been put in special ed when he was 8 for reasons that were pretty unclear, and then just stayed all the way.
Yeah.
Till, you know, now he was graduating from high school, and he was obviously, like, pretty smart and together, and, like, lamenting it and knowing it was wrong, but not, you know, also totally inside of it. And I was just, like, you know, ready to, like, let's get on the phone with the, you know, I don't know. I was like so ready to do something, yeah, or involve myself. Yeah, like, and then I realized, you know, it was sort of fitting in so neatly with something that I'm, you know, that really bothers me, you know, the education system and stuff. So I did just try, yeah, I said, because he had said he was just graduating, and yeah, so I said, so we've met you at a pretty wonderful time in your life. And he totally agreed. He was really proud that he'd graduated from high school. And there was more to it than that, like the transformation he was about to do of going to college, albeit in a special ed way. That he was becoming a man, and that was also what was happening, you know, and he was even sweetly kind of willing to acknowledge that. Yeah,
that was really effective. I mean, that also gets at the perspective issue, because you just finished processing externally, which really works where you're sort of dealing with where you want to go march on Washington or whatever on his behalf, or right, you want to call and get him an internship. But then you're like, well, that's not really, that already introduces some kind of weird class thing where you have the privileged prerogative to be able to do that. And then you sort of, you're not even talking about that necessarily, but it just kind of nicely introduces that, like, you know, you sort of have this, you have to be delicate with the people whose story that you're telling in different ways.
Right. I'm not actually this isn't like a volunteer job, you know, like that's not, no one wants me to, they're actually doing me a favor is what's happening here. Yeah.
You have obviously, I mean, not just here, but in general, maybe let's say an affinity for weirdos, or you could sort of, you know, going back to, I don't know, because you talk about you're like a pen pal with the prison guy from early on. And then, but Ron, this is the guy, the scary guy, was too weird for you. So like, why do you think he got to you as opposed to the others?
I just felt unsafe.
That was a real kind of visceral thing.
Yeah. Or it was the kind of thing, you know, when you're in a borderline situation and you just keep thinking, like, am I not listening to warning bells? And is this later going to be so, like, part of the story is going to be like, why didn't she just, what, you know? And yet you're also... like, no, that's not what's happening here. I've got to be bold. And, you know, I don't even understand why he's under house arrest, frankly. You know, and he did just go on forever, too. So we began to have this, like, trapped.
right.
It's hard to get that across without making, like, a whole book on him. But, yeah, kind of, like, you know, I
How
became nighttime.
There?
You know, it.
Yeah, then yeah. That's right. And the lights came on outside, and all of a sudden you're like, yeah, 4 hours or something.
Yeah, you're just like, I miss my mom. Yeah. Yeah.
But then, I mean, obviously, so to compare Ron to Raymond, who is a different character you haven't discussed yet, but maybe set up that story a little bit.
Right. He was, well, it was a funny thing because it was so open ended. I kind of told myself, like, you're calling the number and going to the house, but it could be anything. Like, maybe the person you're interviewing is not the reason you're there. Like, be alert. It could be, you know, in the walls. It could be someone else who lives there, which in that case, yeah, I met this elderly woman who did just seem like, okay, I've hit upon the one boring person, you know, but very sweet and just talking my ear off. And then her grandson kind of wander downstairs and, you know, what do? He delivers mannequins, you know. Oh, you know, he can bring one downstairs for me. No, let's go up. Should I say? Yeah.
Then
he showed me this woman, Elizabeth Hendrickson, from All My Children that he had met at Disneyland. And then I realized that the mannequin was her. Like, and I was like, how do they look alike? And he was like, yes, I had it specially made to look like her. And I don't really explore that much, as you pointed out. It was just like enough to notice that.
Yeah.
And I, you know, began to notice a lot of other things about the house, like that there were three generations. It was a big fancy house in Glendale. And but I began to realize that there were kind of three generations living in rooms as if they were apartments, you know, with their own refrigerator and food and, you know.
Because technically sort of that is theoretically a scarier moment because there's like a guy who has like a mannequin he's made of somebody he's obsessed with. Like that's the moment where you would turn and then see a mannequin of yourself or something and then realize that.
Right.
And like, and you, but obviously it wasn't, I mean, he was gentle and, I mean, the feeling was different.
Yeah.
With him.
Right.
And so like you, I don't know, I just was kind of, I was curious about, well, I was actually very curious about that because in the book, what happens is the mannequin is described and seen and then you're reading and you're like, that's really weird, right? And then instead of sort of, Miranda doesn't say, hey, that's, okay, well, is that the first stalker mannequin you've ever made or are there other ones or anything? Like, don't just follow questions. And then he just starts talking about, it's really tragic that Michael Jackson died. And then Miranda's like, yeah. Yeah, and then they're like, yeah, it's a loss for our generation. And all of a sudden, then you have this whole riff about how, yeah, we're in the same generation and we have something in common. Me and this guy who just a moment ago had this huge distance because he's a weirdo living in his grandmother's house with a mannequin.
Right.
And like, there's something really nice actually about how you dealt with that.
Right. Well, it shows also how far out I was. I mean, I'd met with Michael, the transgendered man, and then Primula, the Indian woman, and then Raymond's grandmother, who had just talked to me for hours and hours, seemingly. It wasn't that long. And then when I got to Raymond, who was so weird, but when we started talking about Michael Jackson, and then we talked about, I said, do you have a computer? And like, what do you do on your computer? He downloads like Dido and Michael Jackson. I like just the fact that we were talking about computers was really comforting to me. And I had like this kind of exaggerated feeling of like he was 39 and I was 35, I think. And I was just like, gosh, we're like classmates, you know, yeah, it was sincere, but it was also, you know, the second I left, I was like, I'm never going to see him again. It's not like we all hang out together, people of my generation, you know, but it did.
You kind of grasped onto it.
Yeah, I grabbed onto it. And yeah, I mean, truth was of everyone in the book in a weird way. Yeah, I had maybe more in common.
And the person you had most affinity for, I guess, probably would be Joe, who is not your generation at all, but maybe talk about him and that story and then.
Right. Joe, yeah, so near the end of the book, I'm kind of giving up on the vision quest thing and getting just a little bit panicked about the movie, frankly. I meet this old man named Joe and he's 82 and he's made these cards for his wife that are like a zillion of them that are really sweet. They look like this. They have, this is one of them. They have animals cut out and then little typewritten poems. And they're really dirty. The poems are like they have like dripping twats in them and stuff.
They're limericks.
They're limericks. They are. He explains the like off. Rhyming structure
they're
and
sort of
stuff.
Like slant limericks.
Yeah.
The meter's funny.
Yeah. So I mean, if you read this, it's both the story of their lives, kind of reiterated for each holiday, and where they are in their lives now, and then also just very risque, sexual stories. And I guess in as much as I was making a movie about time, it was called The Future, and very much from a 35-year-old's perspective, and having all this anxiety about time, and this is in the book too, about having kids and that time was running out and this really kind of limited sense of my future, his version of the future, and he was about to die. I mean, he talked about that. He's had his list of things he needed to do to the house before he died. He just kind of turned everything upside down. And then there were all these uncanny resonances too. I don't know if anyone saw the future of the movie, but there's a cat named Papa who narrates it, and he had met his wife at Lake Papa 62 years ago. Like, if you're already doing a thing where you're looking for meaning in, random places, like, that's going to seem just funny, like maybe worth noting. And then, because I was very conscious of not wanting to just rip off people's fiction, I was like, well, what am I going to do? I can't just write this into my script, even though clearly I'm being super inspired here. Like, this is not, this seems meant to be. And so I asked him to play himself in the movie, and he does. He's in it in his house, his cards, and I basically reenact our meeting, but I'm not in the scene. I have Hamish Linklater, who plays my boyfriend, acted out. And for Joe, total non-actor, he was a retired house painter. It somehow made total sense to him. He was completely unfazed by it. He was really, really good at improvising also. Obviously it wouldn't have worked if he hadn't been talented in that way. And then I also asked him if he would play the voice of the moon, because later in the movie the moon talks, and I had already written that, and then an old man would do that, and I was like, oh no, now I have these two old men in the movie, and that's confusing. And I was like, no, I don't. There was only ever one old man, and I had to meet him. So I know, in the end, I completely, my fiction sort of, ate up the project of meeting people. But then obviously, when the movie was done, that didn't feel quite right, or even exactly what the experience had been about, which was, why I wrote the book. Yeah.
Well, I think we have to opened up to the Q&A already. It's already a little bit past 8.
Wow.
Do we have, what is the process? Oh, I see. There's okay.
Okay.
I have a question. What was Joe selling?
Right. I changed it in the movie because it was so incredibly confusing, given that he made cards. Unrelatedly, he was selling the fronts of Christmas cards for a like 50 of them for a dollar. He'd gotten them somewhere, and he had an excess by like thousands, and so he was selling them. I bought some, but that was too confusing for a movie, so I have him selling a hairdryer, which someone else was selling, another woman was selling.
But why just the fronts? Had the backs been removed or something?
Yeah, the backs had been removed. I don't know.
Okay. Hello, Rishi. Thank you so much for coming. Personal hero of mine, thanks so much for your time. You seem to be very motivated to, like the book title, Learning to Love People Better, Learn to Love People More. So I was curious to who some of your love heroes, people that guide you and how to love better, such things, or in the past or right now.
Right, like other artists or people, real people in my life who I know.
Real people in your life, of course.
Real people in my life, yeah. Well, you know, I have a lot of really close old friends. I'm the kind of person who like is still hanging out with the people I met when I was 18, and somehow they all live here in LA, even though I didn't. None of us grew up here. So yeah, I have all this continuity in my life. None of them are here because, frankly, I never even mention anything I'm doing because it sort of is irrelevant to our friends. I mean, you know, it's like our jobs. I don't know. I can't explain it, but it's really, those are, whenever I get asked, for some reason, this is always an interview question, who would you invite to a dinner party, living or dead? I always think Lindsay and Shauna and like all the people that I just invite over to dinner anyways. And yeah, there's something about, I mean, I guess you especially find this as you get older, like the way things start to have meaning over time that teaches you more about like love than, you know, like when you're younger, you think, I'm going to meet these great people and that's how I'm going to learn everything, you know? And then, you know, not that they're not great, but you realize like what's great is sort of how it changes over time. Yeah. They're great.
Hi there. We both saw the future and we loved it. And I had a question about the film. Why did Papa have to die?
Yeah. I know. well, I mean, I could say a lot of different things. For one thing, I was thinking, while it is a real cat, and the simplest answer is like, I wanted there to be real consequences to this couple. You know, the reason you don't do terrible things is because it's real, you know, like you're not in a movie, like things can be lost, you know, that you regret forever. That's one answer. On a kind of more symbolic level, I always saw Papa, for those of you who haven't seen the movie, just whatever, this is like free time to just think your own thoughts. I always thought of him as the experience of time that's just waiting, and the kind of waiting that we do that's like blindly waiting for someone to come save you, you know, which I think I've done a lot in my life, like, or to somehow be seen, you know, so I wanted that to be what this character did for the whole movie, and then I wanted that waiting to die and there to be some sense of what the afterlife of like what happens after waiting and how there's a totally inconceivable kind of new sense of self. Like a certain kind of hope dies, but you also, you're sort of free. No one's going to get that just watching the movie, because if I've done a good job, you just care about the cat. but yeah, that was some of the thinking behind it. Yeah.
I was curious about a couple of things. You mentioned that Joe was dying, so I wondered if he had died or if he was able.
Right.
And the other one is, if anybody, this is all Penny Saver people, and did you buy anything from any of them, or did they try really hard to sell you anything?
Right. Joe did die. That's in the book. He died right after I completely finished the movie, like the day after. And sort of the end of the book is finally really meeting Carolyn. No, that's all right. It's not. I mean, this is not like a Hollywood movie. You can know. And I, yeah, because I didn't know what I was doing, the whole thing about did I buy the things? I did a complicated, stupid thing because I was trying to leave all my options open. I bought everything, and then I asked them to keep the thing because I thought maybe what this project will be is that other people, once they read the story, can then buy it. So that would be like, you could then call up, you know, which is very problematic. And, you know, the last thing they want is all these people calling to buy, you know. And that also was years ago.
And they
got
to hold on to the leather jacket the whole time.
Yeah, they were all trying to get rid of stuff. So the chances that they saved everything the way I asked them to, they were just like, oh, okay, so you're buying, but okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah. I don't have anything. Yeah.
Hi. I'm wondering if you are aware of anyone you interviewed in the book having read the book, and if so, their thoughts.
Right, not yet. I mean, it did just come out. So, no, that hasn't happened yet. And it is, you know, I can't say I'm like, sending out copies to everyone. Like, I'm not, and I, that wasn't really the point of it, you know? I pretty much had the feeling when I left each person's house, like, thank you, sorry I've taken so much time, you know, like, you'll never hear from me again, you know? Like, because of course, this is my thing that I think is so important, and just as Joe really could care less whether he saw the movie or not, I kept saying, like, the movie, you know, maybe you want to come to a test screening, like a private, you know, and he just was like, it was the experience of doing it, like my sort of ego, I guess, of thinking like the thing, my finished art was like the point was, in the end, I don't, in some cases it would actually be pretty bad, to be honest, but for the most part, it's just like, I don't think that's the end of the story that all of them were waiting for. I think the end of the story is when I left their house, yeah.
Hi. I'm curious if there's anything you're reading right now or read recently that you really enjoy, and same goes for film, and what books and films you find yourself coming back to again for inspiration?
I was actually, yesterday, just to be very recent, I'd never actually gone to the Paris Review website. Has anyone ever done that? It's got all the interviews. I'll just, maybe that's totally obvious, but like, since I don't really read that magazine, I don't know. Wow, super inspiring. I was like, I never do this, but I was like copying quotes. I was sick copying quotes and emailing them to people all day. Like, this, this will inspire you, you know? It was literally, and it kind of made me have the thought, because I'm now working on a novel or trying to, and I was like, oh, it's especially hard to work on a novel if you're surrounded by, like, filmmaking and doing press for movies and, you know, like, thinking about writing from the perspective of having read all these interviews with writers was a lot easier than when you're in this kind of film mentality, which is easy to get into for me, a filmmaker living in LA, you know? So that was really, really helpful. The Amy Hempel one I recommend, especially. Lydia Davis is a writer I come back to a lot. There's a new book coming out soon called How Should a Person Be by a woman named Sheila Hedy. You must know. Do you know Sheila Hedy?
I don't know. Oh, okay. I know her writing.
Think is really kind of groundbreaking. The things I come back to film-wise are very unimpressive because I have kind of lowbrow taste. The Truman Show, which I already mentioned. Somewhere in Time, which has Christopher Reeves. Kind of a terrible movie that I think is really great. Yeah, okay, I'll just leave it at that because it doesn't get better. Yeah.
Okay, I think we have two more questions.
Hi, my name's Gabe.
Hi.
about a month and a half ago, I was standing in the airport, and you walked past me, like kind of speedily, because you were going to your gate. And a couple days before that, my dad had told me that he had just had a yoga class with you, like a beginner's yoga class, because he just started going to yoga at Silver Lake Yoga.
Right. Since I've gone so little recently,
so is he.
I can almost picture him. Yeah.
And it was just so strange that he had just told me he'd saw you, and then I saw you, and you were headed towards this gate, and I was going to go on a flight soon. And I'd been thinking about where you had been going to, and like if you had a good trip. Like, it had been on my mind exactly what had happened. So I was wondering if you where
really
you went and if you had a good trip.
Both father and son know who the hell I am. That's really great. We both tell him to not give up on yoga like it seems that I have, but I'm not. If I'm in beginner's yoga forever, I'll keep going. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, I was really struck by the thing you said, that at a certain point in doing the interviews, you had to sort of tell yourself not to be telling the story already or being the story already as you were having the experience. That's kind of familiar to me. I'm not an artist at all, but I find myself doing that all the time. And what I specifically was wondering about was, A, whether you succeeded. I know you spoke a little bit to that, but in large part, whether you succeeded in doing that. And secondly, if so, what it was like to remember the experience afterward without putting a narrative structure on it, and were there new narratives that suggested themselves in a way that were not familiar to you. Does that make sense?
Right, yeah. I think I sort of succeeded at the time, maybe only because I was in a strung out enough place that I was kind of open. Like, and that's a good thing to remember. Like, when you're sort of not doing that well, sometimes you have sort of superpowers that you're not going to have when your life gets better again, you know? Like, you're weirdly kind of just looking and wondering what other people are doing, maybe more. But you're right, then writing the book, that's a whole nother thing, because you're actually trying to make something that has a narrative enough that it's going to be interesting. And you're, editing the interviews, you know, each one, I had to take the most interesting parts. So I'm keenly aware of that. And of course, then I was like, oh my God, every interview I'm reading is edited. The whole world is a lie. You know, I became, which for someone who's interviewed a lot, that was a great thing to realize, from the other end, like, this is why you do that. Like, you know, it's your job, you know, as the interviewer. But I think the main story that I made was the one about me, which was actually true. And it was that thing where you look back on your life at a time, you know, where you had so many questions and definitely things did not seem to be coming together. It was a very dark time. And you kind of see, like, that was meant to be, not in some kind of perfect fairy tale way. It continued being really hard, even when I started shooting the movie and whatever. The day with Joe was incredibly hard, you know. But you kind of see, like, it's okay. It doesn't have to be fun for, in the end, to feel like you actually kind of are learning the things that you need to know to live your life and to, like, have good relationships and do your work. I guess it was very kind of, it was very nice for me, after this rough time, it was very reassuring to think, like, well, I can always look back on that and be like, that was a terrible time. It kind of worked out, not just as a book, but also, you know, looking back, you know, I was maybe a little more thoughtful than I I would have been. I would have normally, I think, just been like, get me the hell out of these years and into a happier time, you know? But yeah.
Well, okay. That seems like a really nice note.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.